Pseudopod episode 135, March 27th, 2009. This week's story, The Jewel, by Michael James McFarland. This week's Pseudopod is brought to you by Audible. With a library of over 40,000 titles, Audible are offering you a free audiobook download to try them out. So, go to audiblepodcast.com/pseudopod and claim your book now. Hello, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm your host, Alistair, and this week's story comes to us from Michael James McFarland. Michael's story, The Hypnotist, was published in Gary Conlon's Twilight and received an honourable mention in the 15th annual Year's Best Fantasy and Horror. Your narrator this week is KJ Johnson. So start your engines, start your timers, check your ammo, because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
The Duel, by Michael James McFarland. A what? What did you say? A duel? You heard me, Vanderbilt. D-U-E-L. Duel. You mean like with pistols, 10 paces, turn and fire, that kind of duel? Something like that, John Lawrence affirmed, hands planted on his hips, the breeze blowing casually through his stylish hair, making him look like a young Michael Douglas, right down to the ass-shaped cleft in his chin. 20 years old and living life like it was a goddamn movie. That was Lawrence, all right. This was just the latest example of his madness. A duel. Trey Vanderbilt couldn't help but laugh, even though Lawrence looked dead serious about it. A duel? He stopped laughing long enough to look at the ring of faces surrounding the two of them. Young, clear-skinned faces, yet hungry for all that. Hungry for something their money, good looks, and charm couldn't buy. It was at that moment, standing on a small private beach, gazing into the unsmiling faces of his fraternity brothers, when Trey Vanderbilt began to realize that this might be something more than a bad joke. The next thing he knew, he was holding a gun. Lawrence had one, too. They weren't a match set or anything even close to it, just two pistols which seemed to have fabricated themselves out of thin air. There had been some contention on this point, the two guns being of differing makes and caliber, one a revolver holding 6 rounds and the other fed by a magazine containing 9. But in the end, one boat was judged slightly faster, slightly more maneuverable than the other. And this was where the duel was ultimately to take place, out on the water, each in his own boat, each with his own gun. He who took the faster boat, it was decided, would be penalized with the revolver. The point was argued while Trey stood by, a non-participant, unable to understand how things had gone so wrong, how he'd fallen so far in the eyes of his brothers. This was supposed to have been a pleasure trip, for Christ's sake, a weekend spent relaxing at the lake, not an outtake from Deliverance. The only input he'd had in the matter was deciding between heads or tails at the toss of the coin. "This is crazy," he protested, the sound of his voice echoing through the air, bouncing off the boathouses and coming back to haunt him, the sound of a pig squealing. "I'm not choosing sides for this, no fucking way." Marty Cumberland, who'd emerged as a sort of mediator in the dispute, frowned at this hasty declaration. "If you don't choose, Vanderbilt, you'll get the slower boat and the revolver," he warned. "So choose." The coin flipped and Trey chose, much as the man with a gun in his back will do almost anything for the chance at another breath, another minute of life. Out of reflex, he'd taken heads, and heads it was. His lucky day, Lawrence had said. "What if I say no?" Trey demanded, a cold sheen of perspiration beginning to dot his brow. "What if I refuse to be a part of this?" "You're already a part of this, Trey," Cumberland pointed out, not without a touch of sympathy. "Don't make it harder on yourself. If you don't get in the boat, then John will shoot you where you stand." "That's murder," Trey bleated, tears running freely down his cheeks. "Cold, premeditated murder. You'll go to prison for it." He gave the group an accusatory look. "All of you will." "Not if you've got a gun in your hand," Tim McPherson, who was pre-law, piped in. "Right now, if either one of you shoots the other, it's self-defense. We'll all testify to that." At this point, Trey Vanderbilt began to bawl openly. He tried to speak, but the words ran out in a torn, indistinguishable rush. "Take it easy, Vanderbilt," Cumberland winced, embarrassed. Do you know how hard it is to hit a moving target with a pistol, especially when you're out there on the lake, full throttle, bouncing up and down over each other's wakes? I've never shot a gun before in my life, Trey wailed, pleading with them now. Well, that's hardly my fault, Lawrence grumbled. You ought to lead a more well-rounded life. If you'd rather go at it with knives, Cumberland suggested, we could put you both out on the float. Would you rather do it that way? It's bound to be a lot bloodier. I take it you've used a knife before. Trey told Marty to go fuck himself, to take his fucking knife and go fuck himself. All right, choose then, Cumberland shrugged. Do you want the slow boat or the revolver? When it became clear that they really expected him to go through with it, Trey chose the faster boat. The gun meant nothing to him. He would be equally inept no matter which one they gave him, but with the faster boat he at least stood a chance of outmaneuvering Lawrence. That was something he understood full well. At least tell me why, Trey appealed, watching them count out rounds of ammunition. 357s for him and 9mm rounds for Lawrence. He watched as each bullet was passed silently around the circle from hand to hand, receiving the blessing or curse of every member present. The whole procedure carried with it the weight and solemnity of ceremony. Marty Cumberland presented him with the loaded revolver. "You, better than anyone, should know why, Trey," he answered bitterly. "Think back over the past couple weeks. While you're out there on the water, think about that. I'm sure the answer will come to you." "I'll even give you a clue," Lawrence volunteered, his own gun at shoulder level, the muzzle pointed up at the May sky. He slid back the barrel and chambered the first round with a hard, metallic click. "Ask yourself what you're doing and what you've done to deserve it." "Why won't one of you just tell me?" Trey shouted, frustrated with their games. The black eye of his pistol swayed dangerously about the sheltered stretch of beach. "How can you expect me to think when I'm being chased and hunted?" Lawrence smiled quietly to himself. No one, it seemed, had anything else to say. Cumberland held out his arms as if to give the proceedings a final benediction. "Let's walk out to the boats, shall we?" "Listen to me, Vanderbilt." Marty snapped his fingers in front of Trey's face. "Are you listening?" Trey gave Cumberland a resentful glare, dark strings of hair hanging down in his eyes, then nodded. "Good. Because this is important. I'm going to explain the rules to you, so you might want to listen up." Satisfied he had Trey's attention, Marty took a deep breath. "The duel will last 30 minutes. If both of you are still alive after that time, the contest will be declared a draw, and all charges and complaints against Trey Vanderbilt will be nullified and withdrawn. He will return to the fraternity as a full member in good standing, entitled to all privileges and responsibilities." Here Cumberland paused to regard Lawrence and the rest of the group gathered at the end of the dock. "Is that point clear to one and all?" There was a general murmur to the affirmative. "All right," Cumberland went on, turning his attention from Lawrence to Trey. "If either of you try to dock or land your boat or otherwise attempt to gain outside help, that contestant will be disqualified. Disqualification means you will be hunted down by the rest of your brothers and executed. Is that understood by the both of you?" Lawrence replied that it was perfectly understood. Trey spit a warm wad of saliva into Marty's face, and Marty, wiping it calmly away with the shoulder of his shirt, took that as an unqualified affirmative. "John, since you're the challenger, you'll give Trey a 2-minute lead onto the lake, then the contest begins. You've both got watches to keep track of the time. If they've got alarms, I'd suggest you set them. Otherwise, keep an eye on the boathouse here. When time's up, we'll hang a sheet with a red circle off the roof. That signal marks the official end of the contest, no matter what your watches say. Any shots fired after the sheet drops will result in disqualification, and we've already been through that." A silence fell over the end of the dock as the two speedboats bobbed gently in the water. "Any questions?" Marty inquired. "This is bullshit," Trey growled darkly, baring his teeth at the rest of them, the revolver clutched tightly in his right hand. "But I promise you, each and every one of you will get what's coming to you. I will personally see to that." That's fine, Vanderbilt, fine, Lawrence grinned. But first you've got to survive the next 30 minutes, right? The lake was not a large one, being no more than half a mile across and little more than 3 miles from end to end, nor was it a particularly popular one. It was difficult to launch a boat or even find an accessible beach unless you owned property around it, as the Cumberland family did. So weekend fishermen and pleasure boaters tended to pass it by in favor of other lakes in the region. There were a sprinkling of expensive cabins about the forested shores, by and large owned by bankers, lawyers, and businessmen who didn't mind driving an extra hour to ensure their privacy, but the boys had gotten an early jump on the weekend, and despite the calendar being well into May, now had the calm blue waters to themselves. This was the first thing Trey noticed as he rowed out across its surface. He'd piloted the boat before, though that had been back in October, on a sort of last fling the fraternity had thrown before buckling down for the long stretch toward the holidays. Ironically enough, John Lawrence had been riding along with him. Also, Marty Cumberland, Eric Matthews, and 4 girls whose names and faces, though not their bodies, he had to strain to remember. Terry, that had been his girl, though where she was today he had not the slightest idea. Her name had been Terry, that much he knew, and the fact that she had bottled blonde hair, as evidenced from the dark brown color of her muff, and breasts which admirably filled the large black cups of her bathing suit. After the boat ride and the evening bonfire on the Cumberland's beach, he recalled, reluctantly as one might pick up a dead fish, the heavy petting session which might have led to intercourse had he been able to hold his passion and his liquor a little better. The session ended, after some encouraging stroking on Terry's part, with him ejaculating into the sandy lining of his own swimsuit. And that had been that. What Trey couldn't figure out for the life of him, however, was why he should be thinking about bottled blonde Terry while John Lawrence, waiting only the required 2 minutes, was about to charge out in the Cumberland's boat to hunt him down with 9 very real bullets. The mind surely did work in strange and unpredictable ways, though not always to one's best interest. Visualizing the way Terry's pale breasts spilled out of her swimsuit after some gentle coaxing wasn't going to get him anything but killed. Well, at least I'll die with a hard-on, he thought, laughing incredibly to himself as he glanced back over his shoulder. He still had the lake to himself, but that wasn't going to last for long. Trey approached the south end and slowed the boat down to a crawl, looking for anything in the way of a cove or inlet he might steer for in hopes of burning a few precious minutes off the clock. He didn't see anything that fit the bill, just a few shining boathouses, and he'd been warned about that, and a rocky slope of embankment where the road cut along the edge of the lake. There wasn't so much as a buoy or a piling to hide behind, though even that wouldn't do him much good. Lawrence and all the others had seen the direction he'd sped off in, and if that weren't enough, the ghostly scratch of his wake was still visible atop the lake's calm surface. Shit. He saw a silvery flash cut the water, darting out from the Cumberland's dock, a single craft moving in a wide and leisurely arc, one that bent unerringly south. Trey leaned forward and put the lever in neutral, reasoning that a moving object would draw the eye more readily than a stationary one. He glanced at his watch. It was 11:15. The hunter in sight, still out of range but closing in, Trey Vanderbilt felt his heart beat faster. His breath flew in and out of his lungs in short, shallow bursts. You better than anyone should know why, Trey. Think back over the past couple weeks. His hand trembled on the accelerator, ready to throw the boat into a forward sprint. He cast his mind back and waited for the right moment. A rapid slideshow of random images captured by memory over the last 2 weeks flashed across the screen of his conscious mind, each shot considered and discarded, then picked up again and hesitantly reconsidered. Classes, a dull feeling of hopelessness, of ennui, weeknights spent studying for midterms in the silent crush of the library, tables and chairs, students hunched over dusty stacks of books, a game or two of hearts in the back of the common room. Meals eaten, food chewed and swallowed, the blessed nothingness of sleep. No. Impatiently he discarded the weekdays and spread the weekend out before him, sliced into thin, viewable sections. There had been a party Friday night at the fraternity, everyone blowing off steam after the semester's first round of exams. Saturday had been spent recovering, then back to the library for research materials for an English paper. After dinner, he'd gone with a couple of the guys to a movie, then stopped over at the Cub for a couple of beers on the way back to the house. Sunday. God, what had he done Sunday? Nothing, really. Just more fucking homework, a football game on TV, played some more cards, and went to bed. So what the hell was it? Did someone think he'd been cheating at Hearts? Jesus Christ, that was crazy! John Lawrence was within 100 yards of him now, water wings blazing, catching the light of the sun as the boat ran at him at full speed, like a guided missile. Trey glanced down in panic. The revolver lay like a dead wasp atop the dash, caught in the sharp V between the windshield and the plastic molding. He thought about snatching it up, but couldn't bring himself to take his good right hand off the accelerator at just that moment. Shooting with his left would be a wasted shot. Besides, he still hadn't convinced himself that this was anything more than an elaborate joke. The bullets might have been switched for blanks as they'd been passed around the circle. Either way, he wouldn't be the one to take the first shot. As Lawrence bore down on him, 60 yards in closing, Trey saw him raise his gun with both hands and take aim. Trey's heart caught fire, and he slammed the accelerator forward, cutting the wheel sharply to the right. The speedboat's prow rose out of the water, then gradually leveled off as it picked up speed. Trey heard a sharp series of snaps. Gunshots, he supposed, riding a rush of adrenaline. How many? 3? 4? 5? He wasn't certain, but he felt an impact shudder through the body of the boat. Surely not as many as 5. Lawrence wouldn't waste as many as that, one right after the other, so early in the contest. Would he? Christ, there was still 25 minutes to go! Trey glanced over his left shoulder and saw the boat swinging round to give chase. He pushed the accelerator forward, but it wouldn't go any faster. It was already straining at the end of its leash, moving at top speed as he retreated to the north end of the lake. The boat rose and fell, cutting a rough line through the spreading swells of Lawrence's wake. Trey turned to check the waters behind him, surprised and dismayed to find Lawrence keeping up with him rather well, riding back only 100, 150 yards at the most. He angled the boat 45 degrees east, away from the more populated side of the lake, and Lawrence altered his own course to follow. Need to swing around, take a shot or two to get his head down, then come around behind him, put him on the defensive. Trey's eyes dropped to the gun, still clattering stubbornly against the windshield. He reached down with his right hand and picked it up. "See how you like being shot at, you son of a bitch!" he shouted, the wind in his face, feigning to port, then quickly whipping the boat around to starboard. Lawrence may have been surprised by the move, but if he was, he had time to recover. The two of them met in the middle of the lake like jousters, guns up and firing, each managing to squeeze off 2 shots before the boats carried them away in opposite directions, skimming roughly over the curls of one another's wakes. Trey saw something made of plastic or thin metal shatter inside Lawrence's craft and take flight. His second shot flew from the barrel to no perceptible effect. It may have found a mark, but more likely it had buried itself in the lake or somewhere in the pines along shore. Lawrence's luck was about the same. One of his rounds smashed through the bow and tunneled through the dash, leaving a ragged exit wound that had taken out the controls for the pump, the running lights, and the propeller hoist. The other shot had gone into the water, kicking up a harmless dash of spray. Trey tossed his revolver back to the windshield and, easing back on the accelerator to tighten the turn, wheeled the speedboat around. A cold wash of lake water brushed past his ankles, and, alarmed, he glanced down at the deck behind him. "Christ, I'm taking on water!" Lawrence knew that Trey had the faster boat, so what better way to whittle that edge than punching a few holes in the hull? If it sank, great, but even if it didn't, every gallon that Trey took on was going to add weight and slow him down. Trey pushed the accelerator back up to full, following in Lawrence's wake, matching him turn for turn, slowly gaining. He realized that he was going to have to do whatever he could now to end this duel as quickly as possible. With water leaking in, time was no longer on his side. The gun on the dash whispered his name with a new sense of urgency. "I have a clear shot at his engine, and if I don't hit it, I'm sure to hit the boat at least, maybe even Lawrence." He had 4 shots left. How many, he wondered, could he afford to waste taking pot shots at the engine? 1? 2? Two, he decided, reaching for the revolver, vowing not to waste them. He would be patient, get right up close to the boat if he could. He felt a warm trickle run down his cheek, and when he touched it, his fingers came away red. He frowned, wondering what had happened. Must have been hit by a piece of plastic or something from the dash, he decided, looking down at the hole. It didn't matter. It wasn't going to kill him. Trey glanced at his watch. 16 minutes to go. Again, the nagging question. Why? I'll give you a clue. Ask yourself what you're doing and what you've done to deserve it. What he was doing was fighting a duel. A duel! They'd been careful to put it just that way, as if it were a question of honor. Historically, that's why duels were fought. So think, what have I done in the past couple of weeks to stain John Lawrence's good name, as if it were pure and lily white in the first place? The gap was closing between the two boats. Trey raised the gun and sighted down the barrel. Not yet, not yet, he murmured to himself. The house party, last Friday night. That had to be it. He'd been pretty shit-faced by the time it broke up. In fact, he had no clear memories of it breaking up at all, just waking the next morning feeling like he'd fallen down the stairs on the way to bed. Christ, they'd all been shit-faced by the end. Blowing off steam after a week of tough exams. Who was likely to take anything he said seriously in that condition, or even remember it the next day? He tried to picture Lawrence at the party, and saw him very early on, walking in with his fiancée, laughing and grinning like a man on top of the world, and one look at that girl would tell you why. Amanda White was not only one of the most stunning women Trey had ever seen, she was gracious and intelligent as well. She also happened to be the dean's youngest daughter. Quite a catch, all in all, for someone as painfully average as John Lawrence, who might be termed a good-looking Neanderthal at best. The fogs parted slightly and the party lurched forward several hours. Trey recalled an argument under the big willow tree in the front yard, his view angled from one of the upstairs windows, his eye drawn by the pale lavender of the dress Amanda was wearing. He couldn't hear what they were saying, but the general tone was obvious enough. She was on the attack, mad as hell, and Lawrence, with his hands out, pleading, was most definitely on the defensive. Turning away, Trey recalled being pleased by the fact, as if he'd long held a grudge against Lawrence. But that wasn't so, was it? Hadn't he just helped him out early that week? Cramming for a statistics exam, one that he himself had been fully prepared for? Was that the action of a man with a grudge? Of course not. At any rate, rejoining the party, he had all but forgotten the two of them were out there, arguing heatedly beneath the boughs of the willow. He'd forgotten, but now he wondered what the fight had been about. To get a woman that upset as Amanda had been, a man would most certainly have to be cheating on her. But so far as Trey knew, Lawrence had been perfectly faithful. Cheating. He was close now, very close. He raised the revolver and pointed it at the back of the other boat, his left hand on the wheel, trying to hold a steady course, to keep the right focused on the motor powering Lawrence's boat. Cheating, his mind whispered, distracting him, disturbing his concentration. His hand faltered. Suddenly, he knew exactly what the two of them had been arguing about. Knew it the instant Lawrence turned around and saw him with the gun. He had been cheating, John Lawrence had, but not that way. Not with another woman. He had cheated on his statistics exam. Trey knew about it because the two of them had been studying the night before. Lawrence had been sulking about the formulae they were expected to memorize. Finally, he had slammed his book shut. This is ridiculous! In real life, I could look up these damn things in a book, couldn't I? So why can't we just do it on the test? I mean, come on. What's he trying to prove in making us memorize them? Trey shrugged, wondering what kind of school Lawrence had gone to before college. Did he really expect exams to make that kind of sense? If so, the next year or two might prove frustrating for him. Very frustrating indeed. At any rate, Lawrence's solution had been to write down the half dozen or so formulae on a crib sheet, then slip the paper down on the chair between his legs as the exams were handed out. Funny thing was, one of the instructor's TAs, whom he sprinkled throughout the auditorium to watch for such tricks, sat down in the empty seat right next to Lawrence, in effect trapping him there, because he couldn't get up to leave without the TA catching him with the crib sheet. A 2-hour period was given to complete the test, and Lawrence was there for all 120 agonizing minutes of it, long after most everyone else had turned in their answers and gone to lunch. In the end, he only got away clean because the TA was called down to the podium to assist another student with a problem. Pretty funny, all right, and vaguely Trey remembered laughing as he told this amusing tale at the party on Friday. But had Amanda overheard? And being the dean's daughter, had she decided that John Lawrence might not be husband material after all? 15 yards separated the two boats. Trey steadied his aim and his finger curled against the trigger. Lawrence, however, chose that moment to make a surprise maneuver of his own. Instead of cutting right or left, hoping to dodge the bullet, he held straight and steady and pulled back on the accelerator. The move caught Trey in the worst possible way. With the gun held out over the windshield, filling up his right hand, he couldn't reach back to slow down. He jerked the steering wheel hard to port instead. But with only his left hand free, and the distance between boats being what it was, he clipped Lawrence's stern, and his own windshield took a savage bite into his ribs, just below the armpit. The revolver flew out of his grip, clattering once off the bow before dropping into the lake. Cold, murky water began to pour into the boat as it shuddered away, breaking desperately toward shore, its hull breached, and by more than a bullet this time. Oddly, as the craft listed to starboard, floundering 60 or 70 yards from the shore, what came to his mind was not the probability of impending death, but something his grandfather had taught him when he was 10. "Always wear a life vest, Trey. Whenever you're out in a boat, make sure you've got your life vest on, because you never know what's going to happen out there. You're a good swimmer, I know, but the water can be cold, and if you start to panic, it can pull you under lickety-split." Trey glanced about the flooded deck. There was a bottle of suntan lotion, a thin white T-shirt that now had the look of a boiled jellyfish, an assortment of flotsam that had washed out of a small plastic garbage bag, but no life vests. "Sorry, Grandpa." As the sound of his own engine drowned, he heard the sound of a boat approaching, the only other boat on the lake. The approaching craft idled back, though Trey stubbornly kept his eyes on the spare strip of shore. "Hey, Vanderbilt," Lawrence's voice was calling quietly from behind, like the voice of God. "If either one of you shoots the other, it's self-defense. We'll all testify to that." "Vanderbilt," God boomed, getting irritated now. "Turn around. Face me." The waters of the lake closed over the bow, and Trey felt himself lifted out of the boat. His eyes left the shore long enough to follow the white ring of the steering wheel down through the murky waters and out of sight. When he looked up, Amanda White was floating in front of him, her face cold and resolute, her lavender dress spread out around her like a water lily. "I was going to break up with him anyway. You just gave me a convenient excuse." Her eyes glanced dismissively over his shoulder. "Did you really think I'd spend my life with a Neanderthal like that?" "Amanda," Trey said, pleading, spitting out lake water. Behind him, John Lawrence's lips pulled back from his teeth. Something furious ticked beneath his left eye. "Don't you even say her name." A sharp crack split the air, and the first bullet took him in the back, just inside the right scapula. Blood spilled into the lake, and Amanda faded away. In her place rose Terry, who'd been his girl for a day last autumn. Not as pretty as Amanda White, but not as cold either. She was treading water in front of him, her bleached blonde hair tied back in a ponytail. "I'm sorry for this, Trey. You were nice to me," she said, naked breasts bobbing at the surface. "It was my fault you came too soon." He struggled against the sinking pull of the boat. It sucked him under, and he struggled back to the surface, coughing out blood. "You're not so stupid, Vanderbilt," Lawrence said, soft black curtains falling down. "You knew what this was about all along, didn't you?" Terry reached out to him, and as the second bullet entered his brain, Trey fell into her arms, smiling.
For a while, I was a bouncer. Well, a doorman, technically, but five chunky lads in ill-fitting shirts being paid £11.50 a night to wrangle drunk students sounds suspiciously bouncer-esque to me. I was a lousy job, for two reasons. The first one being you were instantly, basically everyone's worst enemy. And figure of fun, because, you know, you're a bouncer, you can only really do anything, and if something kicks off. And mocking, whilst irritating, is not exactly kicking off. And secondly, because drunk person wrangling in any form is just the least fun thing in the world. There was, of course, a third reason why it sucked, and that was I was very, very bad at it. Despite being built on the large side, I am, or certainly was then, by nature a polite chap. I was diffident, apologetic even, and when everyone else was rousting tables at the end of the night by telling them to sod off out of it, I was asking whether they'd mind finishing their drinks in 5, maybe 10 minutes. There is an implicit confrontation in the job that much, much better writers than me have talked about. Jeff Thompson, who is a terrifying man, being one of them. But then, Jeff Thompson worked in the roughest nightclubs in England, and I worked in a student union. The fact remains, though, that as a bouncer, your job, fundamentally, is to be a deterrent, is to be big, is to be bigger than the other guy. Lead singer of Oxbow, Eugene Robinson, writes in his excellent book, which is one of the funniest and most horrible examinations of the male psyche ever written, it's called Fight, that every man asks a question of himself when in the company of other men. Could I take you? As a bouncer, you have to make sure that the answer is no, and that part of the job, at least, I was good at. If someone decides you'd be too tiring to try and put down, they tend to behave, even if you're wearing glasses and apologising for asking them to leave the bar that closed half an hour ago. Or, to put it another way, being nice is always the best way. Being nice and being big frequently helps. Now, all that stuff about physical intimidation gives me a really awkward segue into the weekly call for donations, so I'm just going to push straight through and ask you under no circumstances to imagine me emerging from your computer screen, arms folded, politely and sternly asking you for cash, because I'm just going to apologise otherwise. We rely on you to pay our authors, it's really that simple. And if you like this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. I promise you they and we will appreciate it. H.P. Lovecraft, along with Edgar Allan Poe, is pretty justifiably regarded as one of the two all-time greats of late 19th, early 20th century horror. Lovecraft's stories of unknowable alien geometries, ancient civilizations, and the gradual dissolution of small rural communities as they are subsumed by impossible, ancient, and depraved creatures are about as far from cheery as you can get, but they've lost none of their impact, even today. The Dunwich Horror is one of his best, although I have to admit I'm also very fond of The Shunned House, and Audible have one of the best versions I've heard of it in a while available. Narrated by Thomas E. Fuller, Bill Jackson, and John Johnson, it's a story that incorporates the depravities of the Whately family, the collapse of Dunwich, and the true reason why the whippoorwills sing. It's a horrible piece, and a massively compelling one, and huge, nasty fun, and it's available from Audible now. Register today, and you can choose a free audiobook from their range of over 40,000 at www.audiblepodcast.com/pseudopod. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. And Pseudopod wants you to know that when there is no more room in hell, the dead will walk the earth, and they will start that walk in Eastbourne.